So, when you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by the prophet Daniel, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down and take what is in his house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he is in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Would you pray with me? Father, thank you so much for your word. Lord, thank you so much that we have what Jesus said recorded here for us to learn from and profit from. God, this is a passage difficult to understand. Lord, please give us grace as we read it. Please give us grace as we discuss it, Lord. Anoint me so that I may proclaim the message that you have recorded here faithfully. And thank you so much for a church family that longs to hear your word, Lord. Bless us today and change us from the inside out. Amen. Have you ever ruined your life? Because I almost did once. So I was 18. I had an acceptance into a military school that I had worked really hard to get in, and I'm driving in a parking lot, and someone does something very rude and then stops their car right next to me. And it's clear, and he opens his door, and he wants to talk. And I don't know what's going on, but I make a terrible decision, and I don't just drive away. And I open my door too, and I just kind of look at him like, what are you doing? That ended with him literally pulling me out of my car and then trying to basically kill me with his fists. And in that moment, what I should have been thinking was, how do I survive this? And what I was thinking was, if I hit this guy even a single time, I might not go to that military school that I worked really hard to get into. So I just dodge it and stuff. So I made a tiny bad decision, and it spiraled into a decision that almost destroyed the thing that I had worked really, really hard for. And that's kind of what this passage is about. It's about something that could be wonderful, but sin demolishes it and leaves it desolate. This passage is about a supreme sin that results in supreme destruction. But we'll see at the end of the passage that that is not the end of the story, for there is hope that Christ will deliver us from that sin. This morning, we are delving into biblical prophecy, which you probably noticed as we read that. And if you are a little hesitant when it comes to biblical prophecy, me too. It is difficult to understand, but hear me, please. These are God's words for us. There is richness and beauty to be found in these words if we would just dig into them. They are for our intellect. They are for us to understand what Jesus is saying to us, but they are also so that we can change how we live. There is rich truth in this passage that will change your life. And last week, Pastor Todd talked about how this passage, chapters 24 and 25 of Matthew, are less about us figuring out the end times, less about us figuring out when Jesus is going to come back, and more about producing within us the sort of character that remains steadfast in the midst of the trials that will come before Jesus returns. So it's less about foretelling and more about faithfulness. So let me say that a little bit differently. Jesus spends very little time telling us when he is going to come back. And he spends a lot of time telling us how we are to live, because Jesus would much rather come back to a holy people than a people who accurately predicted when he would show up. Jesus would much rather come back to a holy people than a people that accurately predicted when he would show up. So let us look at this passage together and see what is Jesus teaching us. And the main point today is that sin causes destruction that only God can save us from. Sin causes destruction that only God can save us from. And like I said, we're in the book of Matthew. This is the context for the day. We're in the book of Matthew, one of the four books of the Bible that directly tell the story of Jesus. And we, as you noticed, are in chapter 24, and there's only 28 chapters. So we are getting pretty close to the end of the book. And before this, if you haven't been here for the past 2.5 years, something like that time, 2.5-ish years that we've been in the book of Matthew, Jesus has been going around from town to town proclaiming the truth of the kingdom of heaven. That's what it keeps saying. The kingdom of heaven. He is inviting people to let him be their king, to submit to him as king. But now things have changed a little bit. We're in a time called Holy Week. So if you look up at the screen, this is a rough timeline of what's going on in Holy Week. The donkey, remember on Sunday, Palm Sunday, Jesus enters Jerusalem? And that should start a countdown in our minds, because on Friday, Jesus is going to the cross. And on Sunday, he's going to rise from the dead. Look how close we are. We are so close. We are there on Tuesday. Jesus has just finished disputing with all of these religious rulers, and then him and his disciples leave those religious rulers, and they go have a conversation on the Mount of Olives. And as Pastor Todd covered last week, chapters 24 and 25, because of that, are called the Olivet Discourse. It happened on the Mount of Olives. Right before this, Jesus has just said, this is critical for understanding this, Jesus just said that he is going to destroy the temple. He is going to destroy the temple. And then it says the disciples come to him privately, which makes this whole passage different, because usually Jesus is talking to crowds. This is what he says only to his people. As his people, we should listen up. And Jesus answers them. And this is how the disciples come to Jesus and phrase this question. So if you look at the screen again, Matthew 24, verse 3, as he, that's Jesus, sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" So that's the context for what we're reading today. The disciples come to Jesus, and they essentially say, "Hey, Jesus, you just said you're going to destroy the temple? And you've been talking about how you have a kingdom and it's going to come to the earth and you're going to fully establish it. So when is all of that going to happen? When are you going to destroy the temple? And when are you going to fully take your throne?" They thought that both of those things would happen at the exact same time. But they didn't quite have the full picture. So to wrap all of that up, Jesus is privately talking to his disciples and answering their question about when and how the temple would be destroyed and how he will establish his kingdom on earth. And you get that, right? Like, haven't you seen the news lately and part of your brain goes, when is this all going to end? Lord, when are you coming back? Isn't there a part of your brain, whenever you hear about a hurricane, whenever you hear about the latest earthquake, that thinks that? We're like the disciples. We want to know when and how these things are going to happen. So let's read verse 15. Now that we have the context, let's read verse 15 and see how Jesus begins his reply to the disciples. "So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place," let the reader understand. So in the passage last week, as Pastor Todd covered, Jesus said there will be some horrible things that happen before he comes back. And he repeatedly encourages people, do not be confused. If anyone comes around and tells you that the end of all things has begun. And that's really relevant today as we are watching bombs fall all over the place and precision-guided munitions, right? And the news are flashing and we all keep getting updates on our phones. But natural disasters and wars are not the way we know when the end times has begun. Jesus explicitly says that. Natural disasters and wars are not the way we know when the end times has begun. But today he tells us there is one thing that's going to happen before he returns. The abomination of desolation. The abomination of desolation. So if this comes before Jesus returns, we should talk about it. We should get a good understanding of what this actually means. And here's a Bible reading rule. Whenever you come across a word in the Bible that you do not use in your day-to-day speech, just pause. Even if you think you know what it means, just take a second and look at it. Because I don't know about you, I never use the word abomination. I never use the word desolation. So I don't know exactly what this means. And maybe you're like me. So let's take a minute and let's look at both of these words. First, abomination. In the language the New Testament was written in Greek, this is an ugly word. Bedelagma. Bedelagma. That's actually how it's pronounced. Something detestable. Something loathsome. Horrible thing which defiles. So this isn't something bad. This is about something supremely bad. This is about something absolutely disgusting. We're talking evil incarnate. What makes your stomach turn? Not because it's gross, but because it's morally gross. That's abomination. And abomination is uniquely a sin against God. So, that's our first word. An abomination is a horrible, disgusting offense against God. Desolation. Now, this means devastation or destruction. But Greek already had a word for destruction, and this word is a little different because the root of this word is the word for desert or wilderness. Desert or wilderness. So it's a sort of destruction that leaves something sparse. And I think you know what this looks like because we've all been through COVID. So I moved to Boston area in 2019 at the very end of the year. And I didn't know anyone, but I wanted to explore. And I would just walk in Boston. One day I literally walked from Boston to this church. It was a long day. And I had so much fun. I'm just a young guy running around. And there was so much life in the city. I've never lived in like a city, so it was kind of fun. And when COVID hit, just a few months after I moved here, I went back into Boston, and it was creepy. There was like no one on the streets. People looking at me with fearful eyes over covered faces. Like there was something eerie about the whole thing. The shops that I used to just wander into were now boarded up. That's desolate. That's desolation. There was a sort of destruction that left everything empty. So putting our two words together now, abomination of desolation, it means something so profane and obscene that it brings about God's judgment and destruction. So before Christ returns, there will be something so profane and obscene that it brings about God's judgment and destruction. And here's why this matters. First, because Jesus said it. That's it. Because Jesus said it. And if Jesus said it, it is worth looking into. Second, because this is a pattern that we see repeated in the Bible and in our own lives. So let us ask ourselves, where is the first abomination in Scripture that leads to desolation? The Garden of Eden. If you look at the screen, this is a painting that you can go see in the museum. Oh, it's very dim, but you can kind of see it. This is a painting that you can go see in the Museum of Fine Arts. And you can see the Garden of Eden. Over to the right, it's lush and beautiful and green. And then over to the left of the painting, it is desolate. All of the trees have died. There's no sun shining. There's a volcano in the distance. And the Bible never calls the what happened in the Garden of Eden, the Bible never calls it an abomination of desolation, but I think it's a reasonable to look at this pattern, because the sin that Adam and Eve committed was wanting to be like God, and it removed them from the lush land and put them into desolation. So it is a type of abomination that led to desolation. And I think we all get this at some deep level. Like, who hasn't been spending time with friends and family, and then they say something that's a little bit too harsh, and the room just goes quiet? And you're like, oh, I messed up. Because the garden, that was that conversation, that time with your family, you ruined it. You committed an abomination, and then it led to desolation in your family. And that's why we're talking so long about this term, because sin matters. Sin is weighty. Sin will destroy everything you love if you allow it to run rampant in your life. But the Garden of Eden is not the primary place we see this term used. It's mainly used for the prophet Daniel. So let's turn back to Matthew. Let's go back to Matthew 24, verse 15. Let's read it again, because this is what Jesus says. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. Great hint. Okay, let's go to the prophet Daniel. Who's Daniel? Daniel was a prophet who came about 600-ish years before Jesus spoke these words. And Daniel prophesied into a time when the people of Israel were in exile. They had been forcibly removed from their homeland. And God gave him a message of both judgment and hope. And God sent him to the people, and now it's one of the books of the Bible, so you can go read about him. And three times, the book of Daniel essentially uses the phrase, the abomination of desolation. Three times. And a lot of biblical prophecy is very vague. And that doesn't mean bad. It talks about types and patterns. But Daniel is shockingly specific. I invite you to go read it. Go read chapters 8 through 12. It gives names, it gives the years, it tells you what things are going to look like. It is unbelievably specific, and we don't have time to go through all of it today, but I would like to read you two verses so we can start to understand what the book of Daniel says about the abomination of desolation. So if you'll look up at the screen, this is Daniel 11, and then another verse from chapter 12. Forces from him is a king, shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering. And they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. And from that time, the regular burnt offering is taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate is set up. There shall be 1,290 days. So we don't have time to go through all of this, like I said, but here's just a few highlights from the prophecy that Daniel has about this abomination of desolation. Right before it, one, a king stops the sacrifices of the temple. Two, a king profanes the temple. And three, a king sets up the abomination of desolation in the temple for 3.5 years. So, stops the sacrifices, profanes, and it's set up in the temple for 3.5 years. Here's why this matters. There was a king 400 years after Daniel prophesied this named Antiochus IV. So that marble bust that you can see in the bottom, that was made while he was still alive. So we can now recreate marble busts into what they probably look like. So this is actually probably roughly what he looked like. He was the king of the Seleucid Empire, and he was absolutely vile. And if you go to the next slide, this is a rough timeline from when it happened. So like I said, about 400 years after Daniel. And Antiochus IV conquered Jerusalem. And he did a lot of vile things when he did so. And we have a record of it in the book of 1 Maccabees. So here's what 1 Maccabees says. And the king, that's Antiochus IV, sent letters in the hands of messengers to Jerusalem to withhold burnt offerings and sacrifice, and to defile the sanctuary and holy things, to build altars and shrines and idols, and sacrifice pigs and common beasts. And on the year that is 167 BC, they built an abomination of desolation on the altar. Now, this is not one of the books of the Bible, but this is shockingly specific and written by the Jews. And it fulfills all three things that we just talked about from the book of Daniel. Look, Antiochus, he stopped the sacrifices of the temple. He profaned the temple, and he set up an abomination of desolation. And guess how long it stood there? Almost 3.5 years, like almost exactly. The timeline is shockingly perfect. So 400 years before it happened, the prophet Daniel accurately prophesied about what would happen with Antiochus IV. But why am I giving you this history lesson? Because Jesus talks about it as if it hasn't happened yet. Right? Look at verse 15 again. Jesus says, so when you see the abomination, when you see the abomination of desolation. And if you comb through the prophecy of the book of Daniel, you're going to notice a few things that don't quite line up with Antiochus IV. The way he died is different. There's a couple timeline things that are a little bit different. So what are we to do? Was he the fulfillment of the abomination of desolation? Or is there something else? So I think we struggle with this because of the way we read prophecy. We are Westerners, and we like 2 + 2 = 4. We like our prophecy like a light switch. We want it on or off. Has the prophecy happened or has it not? But I propose to you it might be more like a vase. It might be more like a vase. So imagine we have a prophecy that says, water shall pour from a cup into the vase. Has the prophecy been fulfilled? Yes, it has. But is it fully filled? No. So maybe there's a category in the Bible. And this is how the Bible works. There is a category in the Bible where prophecies can be fulfilled at multiple times and in multiple ways. It's like they build upon each other and the vase just gets fuller and fuller and fuller. And 30 to 40 years after Jesus spoke these words in Matthew about the abomination of desolation, the temple of Jerusalem was actually destroyed. Roman forces marched into the city, slaughtering and burning as they went, killing hundreds of thousands of Jews, if the records are true. And this really lines up with what Jesus is saying in this passage. So let's read verses 15 to 21, Matthew 24, 15 through 21, and see how much it lines up. So when you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by the prophet Daniel, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. By the way, we're the reader, right? So we better understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be on winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. You see how horrible whatever Jesus is talking about is. Imagine something so horrible you don't run inside to grab a single thing from your house. Imagine something so horrible that during a Boston winter, you don't take the time to grab a coat. You just run. That's what Jesus is talking about. And this is especially impactful as I was reading this because I have a pregnant wife. And it says, alas for those who are pregnant. And can you imagine someone who is pregnant having to sprint? It is not a pleasant thought. And this really lines up with what happened in Judea. We read in this passage, the people of Judea will need to flee, and they did. When the Romans slaughtered the temple, or slaughtered the people and destroyed the temple in 70 AD, We read that it will be great tribulation, and it was. And Jesus is even answering the disciples' question about when the temple will be destroyed. So, was this the abomination of desolation? I say yes. It certainly seems like it was. But is the vase full? I don't know. Had there never been a tribulation like that before? Has there not been tribulation that bad since? Further, the Romans didn't even set up some sort of altar that lasted for 3.5 years. So if, I'm not telling you it's not, but if the pitcher isn't full, I want you to imagine what that's going to look like. Imagine if that sort of destruction came to Winchester or whatever town that you live in. So we've been talking about the abomination of desolation for a while now, right? We've talked about it in reference to the Garden of Eden. We've talked about it in reference to Antiochus IV. We've talked about it in reference to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. But now what? What do we do with that? Before the temple was destroyed, the Apostle Paul wrote a letter to some people who had been taught that Jesus had already returned. And that's the book of 2 Thessalonians. And in the book of 2 Thessalonians, we get this paragraph, starting in chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. Now concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our being gathered together to him, we ask you, brothers, not to be quickly shaken in mind or alarmed, either by a spirit or a spoken word or a letter seeming to be from us to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. So pause real quick. Paul is saying almost the exact same thing that Jesus is saying right here, right? He's saying, if people tell you the end happened, if people tell you that Jesus came back, do not believe them. Let's keep going. Let no one deceive you in any way, for that day will not come unless the rebellion comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself against every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. That sure sounds a lot like the abomination of desolation too, doesn't it? So Paul says, before Jesus comes back, there will be a man who is opposed to God's law, who will set himself in the place of God, taking his seat in the temple, and saying that he is God. And many believe this figure is a human version, is a person version of the abomination of desolation. Is it? Church, I'm going to be honest. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not here to give you the final answer on that today. I'm here to talk about how we live. But I want to quickly give you a survey of the answers, just like Pastor Todd did last week. So if you look up at the screen, there's essentially, and there's a bunch of breakdowns within this, but there's essentially three groups of people, like Pastor Todd said. There's people that say, the abomination of desolation, it happened. It already happened. In 70 AD, when the temple was destroyed, when the people of Judea were slaughtered, that was it. Then there's people that say, no, that wasn't it at all. That didn't fill up that vase in any way. The vase is completely empty, and it will happen one day. This is something future, and it's worse than any of us could imagine. And then, of course, there's people who think both. There's people who think, yes, that was the abomination of desolation, but yes, there is something to come. Or maybe that it is a type that will be repeated over time, again and again. And like I said, my goal today isn't to convince you of a position. Like I said in the beginning, Jesus would much rather come back to a holy people than a people who accurately predict all of this sort of stuff. So the goal today, what do we take away? First, we need to learn because Jesus taught. So we must learn what he said. Second, we need to recognize the seriousness of sin. We need to recognize that abomination leads to desolation. When I was a kid, I was pretty young. A bunch of my family members went to the beach, and I was walking on the beach with an older married man in my family. And I clearly saw him give a girl the up down with his eyes. He just full on checked her out while I'm watching him. And I kind of tap him and I'm like, hey man, like, he's a married Christian guy. He's not supposed to do that, right? And he looks down at me and says, I can't order anything off the menu, but doesn't mean I can't look at it. Let me rephrase. I can commit a little sin. It's fine. Hey, students, I wouldn't cheat on an actual exam, but I can use ChatGPT for my homework answers, right? Like, it's not that bad. So you use ChatGPT this week for your answers, and it's fine. And then next week, you don't understand the homework again, so you decide to use it then too. And then guess how easy it is the third week. You do that every week for the whole semester, then you do that every week for the year. If you do that for the entirety of high school, you're going to be 18 with the knowledge of a 14-year-old. You will graduate and be a fool. What you thought was a tiny sin blossomed into an abomination that became desolation. Young men, you can look at that website, right? It's not actual pornography. Go to that website once today, and it'll be far easier to go tomorrow. Go there tomorrow, and you're hardly going to notice going there the third day. Spend 5 minutes on that website every day for the next year and watch how it warps your mind. And then try to explain to your godly Christian wife one day that you spent 10 years enslaved to pornography, and watch the garden that seemed like your marriage become desolate. Moms, I have no idea what you go through. But I asked a mom, and this is what she wrote me. It's pretty rough seeing all those perfect moms on Instagram, huh? The first post is so easy, you know, that app you downloaded to help fix the pimple that you didn't want to broadcast to the entire world. And then you post again the next day, but this time you throw a little makeup on and make sure that your hair looks good. Then the next day you spend 10 minutes trying to think of a clever caption that will impress all your friends. And every like, wow, it just makes you feel so good. Until you don't get as many as you did on the last post. Do that a few times a week for 5 years, and now you're completely dependent on validation from Instagram. You'll find yourself putting more effort into your appearance so online people notice, and then your kids get less attention because you're busy staring at your phone all day. And then your daughter will grow up and want to be just like you. Your abomination breeds desolation. The Apostle James sums this up really well in James chapter 1. He says, but each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. Do you see that progression? At first, you're not even doing anything wrong. You are being tempted by something. But then you allow that temptation in, and it enters your heart, and it becomes desire. And then that desire does something within you, and then you commit, and you sin. And that sin continues to grow and brings forth death. So here's my point. Sin is not content to stay small. Sin is not content to stay small. The sin that you think is small will become an abomination, and your abomination will cause desolation. And pause for a second here, because I really don't want anyone to think that I'm saying that Jesus' main point today is about our personal sin. It's not. Jesus is talking about the abomination that causes the desolation, but it is a faithful application of what Jesus says to notice that that is a pattern throughout Scripture and a pattern in our own lives. It is a faithful application of this principle to realize that abomination's natural end is in desolation. But we all sin, right? Are we just hopeless? We're all constantly messing up. How on earth could this wrong be made right? Thankfully, Jesus answers that in this passage as well. So, if you'll join me in reading verses 22 through 27. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Look back at verse 22. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. The elect are those chosen of God. The elect are Christians. So the first thing we can take away from this is that God will not forget his people. God does not forget you. God does not abandon you. He will stick closer to you than a brother. He is here in your time of struggle, here in your time of temptation. Jesus does not forget you. Verse 24 says, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. This means that there are going to be people who claim to actually be Jesus himself. And we need to not be fooled. There are going to be people who claim to hear messages from God that actually don't, and they'll even do amazing signs and wonders with the goal of leading believers astray. And that doesn't mean that believers are going to lose their salvation. It means people are coming for you. People are coming for you. Jesus is clear that no one is going to know exactly when the end has begun. And as Jesus has already said, let me just repeat, if anyone tries to convince you he's already returned, you say, no, sir, no, he hasn't, because his coming will be like lightning. And this is really important today, because we have more information at our fingertips than anyone ever has in the history of the planet. If you want a prophecy, you can go on Google, you can go on YouTube, and you can find a prophecy that fits whatever you think. So we need to be really, really careful with who we listen to and what prophetic words that we engage in. And that doesn't mean there is no prophecy. Notice that Jesus doesn't say, and don't listen to anyone who says they prophesy. He says, don't listen to false prophets. So joyfully and eagerly hope for prophecy, but be wary, knowing that there are those who will intentionally deceive us. And now we get to our ultimate hope here at the end of the passage. Would you read verse 27 with me? For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Have you ever seen lightning? You know when you're out and about and you probably shouldn't be walking around because the storm's starting and lightning comes and it just terrifies you, doesn't it? The crack of thunder when you weren't expecting it. You do that thing, your head goes down and your shoulders go up really fast. You're like, oh, what was that? It is sudden. It appears. It just comes out of nowhere. That's what it's going to be like. No one sees it coming. No one's going, hey, look, there's Jesus. He's on his way. No, it will happen in an instant. So what is the hope of as we face our wickedness and our sin? The God who is powerful enough to do that, he can set us free. He is coming back. And when he comes back, it will not be something quiet. We have no need to fear the abomination of desolation, for we are on the side of the God who comes back like lightning. In the book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible, towards the very end, in the 19th chapter, we see what it will be like when Jesus comes back. And this is what it's going to be like. Then I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. The one sitting on it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes are like a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems, that means jewels. And he has a name written that no one knows but himself. He is clothed in a robe dipped in blood. And the name by which he is called is the Word of God. and the armies of heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, were following him on white horses. And from his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. He will tread the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God the Almighty. On his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Anyone think they won't notice that? Jesus will come back in power to defeat the abominations and to remove the desolations. He will judge those who are not with him, and he will save those who are. The rightful king will take his place. So live your life for that. Live your life for that day. Who or what is the full fulfillment of the abomination of desolation? I don't know. But I do know that my sin becomes an abomination that causes desolation, and that only Christ can save me from it. And that's the point today. Sin causes destruction that only God can save us from. And if that king will come and easily defeat Satan with the armies of heaven behind him, how easily can he defeat your sin? If you are overwhelmed this morning by the weight of your sin, turn to the king. If you are caught in a spiral of sin, turn to Christ. Turn to the one who can forgive your abominations and save you out of your desolation. In the moments of temptation, stop relying on yourself. Cry out to him. That's what it means to turn to him. Say, Lord, I cannot handle this. Lord, I'm about to sin again. Save me. Lord, I need you to help overcome this, for I cannot do it on my own. Earlier, we talked about how sin progresses. What seem like little sins fester until they become great abominations. So what do you practically do? First, just like I said, you turn away. You turn away from that sin towards Christ. Are you the student cheating with ChatGPT? You stop using it. And then you go to your teacher and you say, I am so sorry for what I did. And then you're going to have to learn how to study. And that's going to be difficult. You turn away. Second, you remember that righteousness also progresses. Righteousness also progresses. So just like if you spend a lot of time doing something bad, spend 30 minutes a day reading your Bible and praying for the next year, and that's 182 hours of time that you will have spent with God by the end of the year. That's 4.5 working weeks that you will have spent with God. Do that for 10 years, and it will change everything about you. Righteousness will progress within you. He will shape you. He will form you into who he wants you to be. And then, when the abomination of desolation comes, we will be ready. We will fall upon God, knowing that we do not have the strength to face it, but that he does, and that he is our help. Pursue God today. Remember that this world is not forever, and rejoice, for Christ will return. Would you pray with me? Mighty Father, you have been so, so good to us. God, save us from our sin. Lord, save us from the little sins that add up. Save us from that spiral. Lord, you are mighty and you are powerful, and you will return. God, you are the only one who can change our hearts. Lord, if there are those here today that do not know you, that have never been saved from that sin, oh, Lord, call them to yourself. Let them know how great and wonderful and peaceful is the friendship of God. Lord, for those who know you and are just bogged down day to day, fighting the weight of sin, give us lasting freedom, Lord. Every day, help us put on the armor of God and help us do battle against the sin that would so easily ensnare us. You are good, you are holy, and you will be faithful to your people. Come now, Lord, and change us from the inside out. Amen.